to keep my book up.
Is that enough?
Yeah.
Don't knock it off.
Well, thank you very much for that, Saruti. A very warm, much appreciated intro. Thank you. Well, I do feel quite moved. I hope I'll be able to contain myself and get into it. I'm sure I will, but please excuse me just at the beginning. When I arrived, Saruti greeted me with his usual warm greeting, slapping me on the back. And, hello, old chap, he always says. And just before he left, after that greeting, he said, we might ask you to do something. And I thought, oh, good, because I have got something to offer. What's been rattling about in my mind over the last few weeks is a particular poem by Rilke, the great, I think he's technically Austrian, but wrote in German. And that's the first of his 50-odd sonnets to Orpheus, the god or half-god of music. And I was intending to sort of unravel this poem and talk about it. That would be the theme of my offering. That was last, when was it? Saturday, when I arrived. But everything's changed. Changed utterly. To quote from Yeats, a terrible beauty is born. That's what he says. I don't think it will be a terrible beauty. But thinking about beauty and listening to Saruti and Padmavajra over the last few days has just stirred me up a lot in a very positive way. And it's just changed my program completely. So in a sort of way, I'm a bit at sea. But maybe that's a good thing. I have difficulty preparing, usually, for something like this. And it's been curiously difficult on this retreat because I've been doing it on the hop. But it's also been very helpful because I, in my head or even writing down, I prepare a few notes and then Saruti and or Padmavajra say something and I have to sort of change it and add something else because they've inspired me. So I really do, I have to leave tomorrow evening at 5 o'clock, so I'll miss sort of final reportings out and things. But so I do want to say, take this opportunity to say how much I appreciate the offerings of Saruti and Padmavajra over the past few days. I feel they truly have been inspired utterances, udanas, in their own right. And I was very impressed when Saruti said that he finds it impossible to prepare. I thought, my God. And he says, yes, it can be quite nerve-wracking. I thought, oh gosh, well. And it reminded me of a DVD I'd seen of the jazz musician Keith Jarrett talking about the art of improvisation. It's a brilliant DVD. And Jarrett says in the course of that talk, he says, you got to take risks. He plays in a trio. And he says, if Jack, who's playing the double bass, takes up something, I think, is it worth going with that? It may not be, but I go along with it. And that's a risk, you know. So I felt very much that, in a way, Saruti is improvising. He's thinking on his feet. And I feel quite envious about that. Anyway, this theme of the importance of beauty, I do feel it's been a bit neglected over the years. It's always been there, but it's been neglected over the years. And I may as well make this point now, but I feel it's particularly important at the present time. And one reason I feel it is important is to affirm what Subhuti said this morning about all this talk of insight, even in the order. I think it's very good that we're all talking about insight, because insight is crucial, of course. Insight will take us to the very, at least to stream entry and beyond. So I don't want to dampen that down. But I do feel, as Subhuti expressed this morning, I agree with him, that sometimes the talk about insight, even by friends of mine who have actually gone through the gate in terms of Liberation Unleashed, I feel sometimes, to some extent, that it's a little bit too cognitive. And I think, well, and I even heard that one person had said that, oh, it's not necessary, or he doesn't do the metta bhavana anymore. I thought, what? So I think this is quite important, that we do keep the very strong emotional element and the theme of beauty going. And I hope that all of us here will help to sort of put the message abroad when we go back. Anyway, that's all by way of introduction. I'm going to get carried away, I'm afraid, but I don't mind. My intention here, I've written, my purpose is to present to you a few of my own personal responses to these inspired utterances of Pamavajra and Subhuti. So these are indeed my own personal responses. I'd like to think of my words as giving some kind of account of my own gestalt, in the hope that it will link up with yours, your gestalt and your gestalt and your gestalt, etc. I was on that seminar, I think it was a weekend seminar, was it, on the Kalama Sutta. I was on that seminar when Bhante first came out with this image of the gestalt, about this idea of the gestalt, but when he also expressed it in terms of the image of the carpet, the Persian carpet unrolling. That really, for some reason, grabbed me. And where you see certain threads appearing in your life that you've got to follow through. That was quite powerful for me. And on this retreat, listening to the talks, meditating, doing pujas, and also interacting with the members of my group, thank you very much, I feel that certain threads have crossed, either over or under my own thread. And, of course, the crossing of a few threads is the beginning of weaving. And weaving leads to tapestry. So it's a very potent image for me. I want to cover, going back to my preparation, now, before that, I want to say that it's very well known that old people reminisce a lot. As they get further and further from the old days, they reminisce about them more and more. So I warn you, I'm going to reminisce. But I want to put these reminiscences, these few reminiscences which I'm going to offer you, I want to put them in the context of the retreat. I want to place them securely in the context of the theme of beauty and the importance of beauty in the Dharma life. So yes, I want to cover three areas. I want to explore a little bit, if I've got time, three areas this afternoon. And the first area is to explore a little bit that very striking utterance of Lama Govinda to the effect that Kalyana Mitrata is the flashing forth of the cosmogonic eros. Fantastic. My first reminiscences relate to that. My first encounter with the Dharma was back in 1967. I was living in Bangkok. I lived in Bangkok for 2 years. And towards the end of my stay in Bangkok, a friend of mine introduced me to a Dharma text called the Tibetan Book of the Great Liberation. And it was a translation of a terma. I didn't know it was a translation of a terma then, but it was. And it was translated by Evans Vance. And it was later, many years later, retranslated by someone called John Murdin Reynolds. And its title is Seeing Liberation Through Seeing with Naked Awareness. Self-liberation through seeing with naked awareness. This text had a very big impact on me. It went really deep. It did leave me feeling, as that refrain from the poem that Subhuti quoted this morning by Tarkovsky's dad, there has to be more. So I left Bangkok in 1967, fired up, thinking, there has to be more. And I said to my wife when I got back, her father had died, and 3 months later I rejoined her, and I think she was a bit taken aback because I was slightly different. And I said, we've got to find a Buddhist group. And we discovered a little advert at the back of the New Statesman for a retreat, very small box, a retreat in Hazelmere. Friends of the Western Sangha, it was called. And it said vegetarian food. And we thought, that's a bit cranky. But then, we'll give it a go, we'll give it a go. So we went. Oh my gosh, what an experience. It was held at a Tibetan foundation house called Quatermain, and we arrived, and as we walked in, there was this monk with very dark hair, about half inch long all round, and big glasses, and he looked Indian to me. I thought, is he Indian or is he English? Couldn't quite make out. And he shook hands with us. And this was my first contact with Bhante. And on that retreat, I won't go into many more details about the retreat, but he introduced us to the mindfulness of breathing. And yes, it was. It was mindfulness of breathing. And everyone, we're all sitting on upright chairs. There were one or two really weird people actually sitting cross-legged at the front. But he taught us the mindfulness of breathing, you know, in his measured, careful, down-to-earth sort of way. at the end of the, and my goodness, talk about beginner's mind. I took off, and it was a fantastic experience. And then, about 2 years, 1 year later, I started, not regularly, but periodically, spending weekends with Bhante. I spent a weekend with, he came to visit us in Bournemouth. My wife and I were living in Bournemouth at the time, and his father lived near, in the New Forest somewhere. So he stayed a weekend with us. And periodically, I would go to visit him for a weekend in London at his flat in Highgate West Hill. So what I'm saying here is that in those days, you could have lots and lots of personal contact with Bhante. So I feel very, very fortunate to be so old in that respect. You know, I want to talk a bit about my something that happened on one of those weekend visits. Because we were spending a lot of time together, we got into deeper communication, which I didn't find easy because I was a bit apprehensive. You know? And on this particular occasion, we got into a bit deeper communication. And he said to me, I remember he said to me, "I hope you don't feel overwhelmed." And I said, "No, Bhante." Sorry, I exaggerate. Of course I did. I did feel overwhelmed. It's an overwhelming experience. And he said, because I remember he said, "I feel your being very strongly. I feel your being very strongly." And I thought, wow. And that to me was a very powerful affirmation. It was almost like a bit of an abhishekha almost. And I've pondered on that over many years. And I've pondered on it this week while I've been considering what I would say to you. And I think it's a very good example of the more spiritually developed individual giving affirmation to the less developed spiritual person on the path. And I think this is a very vital element to Kalyanamitratha. And it's something I think which we've all experienced in our own interactions, either side of the relationship, either in relation to a vertical KM or, you know, downwards. And I was saying in the group the other day that sometimes we don't realise the effect of the things we say. I've had people come up to me and say, "You know, you once said to me way back in 1983 or, you know, yonks ago, you said this and it had such a powerful effect on me." I mean, it's, you know, the words themselves didn't say very much. I've nearly always forgotten. But, you know, it's very important. And I felt on that particular occasion, it was so intense that I felt it was, in terms of Govinda's quote, a bit like the flashing forth of the cosmogonic eros. So I'd like to say at this point, in case I forget, that I don't see these memories as just reminiscences. These are memories that have sort of acquired over the years a sort of mythic quality. There's something mythic about Bante in the early days. People have used the word shaman. Something magical about Bante in the early days. I'm not saying there hasn't been magic in Bante in the later days, there has. But it was very special then. It was very special. And it has to do, and this is me recollecting in tranquility, this has to do with the founding of the movement. It was August 1967 when I came across the movement, and these incidents I'm telling you about were late 1968, early 1969, by which time there were only two or three, well, about a handful of order members. So, you know the story of Bante sitting with Terry Delamere on a train in somewhere in India and saying, reading this letter, where he was banished by the British establishment in London. And he said, you know what this means? It means a new Buddhist movement. And it came to him in a flash. That's the impression I get. And so he started it. And 1967, 1968 was the beginning of this movement. So I think that's a very, very important time. It's a time when something of really crucial importance to all of us started. The ball started rolling. So that's one reason why I feel so charged up. I feel so, it's such a powerful subject to be covering. Yes, the myth of Bante, I've written, at the beginning of the movement, a very significant time, which has become mythical in the positive sense. It's part of my personal myth. Okay, so I'm going... That's the first... area I want to cover, and the second one is to do with beauty and pleasure. Beauty and pleasure. I'll start by picking up on something that Subhuti expatiated on. What he called the fourth characteristic of beauty. And he said, beauty is ecstatic. It pulls you out of yourself. The quest for the beautiful is the path of insight. And when he said that, or shortly afterwards, he said, this illuminated for me... He didn't say that. I'm saying that. I'm saying this in my head. In my head it came. This illuminated for me another incident from the early days with Bante. When the young, impressionable neophyte, that's me, was walking along with the master. In those days, Bante didn't walk, he glided. It's partly the fact that he had the robes. I always think of him as gliding. You know, we glide to Sakura for the class. We glide through the foyer of the underground and then through the streets of London. And then afterwards, we glide up Parliament Hill Field. Well, he would glide and I would be sort of walking after him. Anyway... this particular incident was when we were walking along Highgate Village, High Street, and we just returned from Highgate West, Highgate Cemetery. It was a beautiful August day, and he'd taken me to Highgate Highgate Cemetery, which is an old Victorian cemetery, which was all overgrown. The graves are all overgrown. And there are these mausoleums, you know, you can, like, walk in and... I won't go into too much detail, but he'd introduced me to this, gliding amongst the the graves. And it was a beautiful August day, and there were butterflies fluttering, and there were buttercups and wild flowers, you know. I was sort of blown off my feet, in a way. Anyway, we went to the local shop, and he bought some salad for lunch. And we were walking along, and he suddenly said to me, "I feel blissful." Something like that. I can't remember the exact words. "I feel blissful. In fact, almost ecstatic." "With luck," he said, "it will soon become permanent." He said it quite casually. No, it wasn't like, "Oh, I feel blissful, you know, man, do I feel happy." It's like very sort of casual. But there was something about that, the casualness, that all this sort of bliss and energy was like really well contained, and I did feel a sort of tinge of envy mixed in with my wonder. He said very much the same thing in a letter to me, maybe a year later. He said, I wish I'd quoted it. He said, "These days I feel almost ecstatic most of the time." I think he was writing from America, where he was lecturing at Yale University for a period. So that really struck me, that here was a man who, to my mind, really embodied the Dharma in the highest sense. And that embodiment of the Dharma was so beautiful that he felt ecstatic most of the time. But I want to add a little coda to that, because maybe a year later... Sorry, there's Surat walking. Maybe a year later, I was sitting in Bhante's room with him. It was November day. It was a dark November day. And we were sitting in front of one of those old-fashioned gas fires. You know, and he had a stick of incense burning. And I was in a terrible state. I was feeling really bad. And I said to him, "I feel desperate," I said. "I feel desperate." And his response wasn't to, "Oh, I'm very sorry to hear that. You know, why is it and what can I do for you?" None of that. His response was startling to me. He said, "The best of us feel desperate at times." The best of us feel desperate at times. So then I realised... his ecstasy wasn't permanent in the sense that it was continuous, and that there must have been times for him in those early days when he too felt desperate. And looking back, you know, starting a movement with all sorts of weird characters that we were and trying to get it all together must have been a right headache. I think that's why at times he must have felt desperate. So this too, in its strange way to me, is inspiring, because the path is, you know, joy and sorrow woven fine, and it's joy and sorrow woven fine right up the ladder. We're not going to be blissful all the time. I think that's all I'll say about the second area, which is the relationship of bliss to insight, ecstasy to insight. So I'm going to come now to the subject of the religion of art, because that is a it's an area which I'm very interested in, and the importance of art in the pursuit of beauty, and its prominence in Bhante's presentation of the Dharma. So my third and final reminiscences have their place here in the religion of art. So I discovered in those early days of 1968, 69, that one aspect of Bhante's rich complexity was that, like me, he was something of a literary man. And in that respect, I looked on him as a kind of soulmate. And what struck me was that his love of literature was fully integrated into his sure grasp of the Dharma. Remember, this was the late 60s, and it's quite a long time after Bhante had integrated Sangharakshita I and Sangharakshita II. They were perfectly integrated by that time, and he was off. And it was long after the publication... It wasn't long after the writing of The Religion of Art, but it was long before the publication of The Religion of Art. That hadn't quite come onto the horizon yet. So we used to discuss literature a lot, especially the Romantic poets, and to some extent Shakespeare. And... it wasn't just poetry, it was also art, visual art, and it was music. And film. Film was very important. He just discovered film. And I remember one day I went with him and a young order member, I can't remember his name. We went to the Baker Street Classic in London, and we went to a Pasolini double bill. And it was Pasolini's, I think, Sophocles Rex and Teorema, which Subhuti talked about the other day. Unfortunately, I'm sure he said a lot about both films, but I can't remember anything he said. But, you know, he did that. We went to a Van Gogh exhibition together. We went to a Van Gogh exhibition at the Hayward Gallery in 1968 or 1969. And I noticed how absorbed, easily and quickly, Bhante got absorbed in the pictures. But it was mainly because of my interest, literature. And... I don't know whether I'm conflating two incidents here, but I think it was the same day, that wonderful August day of Highgate Cemetery, followed by I Feel Ecstatic. In the evening, we went for a walk. We went for a walk in Hampstead, a very beautiful area, and we were walking along Mill Lane, famous Mill Lane, and he suddenly stopped, and he said that, "It's round about here," he said, "that Coleridge bumped into Keats." I thought, wow, this guy knows so much more about... But actually, I knew about the incident. And he said, oh yes, he said. He said, they chatted for a time, and then Keats left, and Coleridge said to his friend, Dr. Gilman, he said... About Keats, he said, "There's death in that hand." It's proved to be maybe a bit of an apocryphal story, but it is a wonderful story because Keats actually died of consumption a year later. I just say that because that's really always stuck in my mind, that incident, and I've always loved the poetry of Keats. And Shakespeare, And just jumping ahead a bit, round about 1979, I was living at Padmaloka with Subhuti and others, and I decided I wanted to give a talk on the convention on the subject of Buddhism and John Keats. And I went up to Bhante's room to get the this rubber stamped, so to speak. And I said to him, Bhante, I said, I'm keen to do a talk at the convention on Buddhism and John Keats. I don't know whether I expected him to say, well, I think it'd be better to stick to strictly Dharmic subjects. He immediately went to his bookcase and took down three or four books about Keats and just thrust them into my hand. So that was affirmation. So how am I doing? Ah, yes. One more little saying. I once asked him, this is going back to 68, 69 again, I said, I mean, I knew he was keen on literature and he'd integrated it with his love of the Dharma and so on, but I said to him, I asked him, why do you think that it's so relevant and important, this love of literature and in relation to the Dharma? And he said to me, it's a good way of non-being. So I pondered on that. I think he would alter that a bit these days and go further. But it reminded me of that sutta that Subhuti mentioned this morning, that I'd mentioned at a retreat at my scrim. It's called What is Difficult? And in case you were sparked off by that reference, it's in the Samyutta Nikaya, right near the end, and it's very, very short. It's only about three paragraphs. And the first difficulty, just to fill you in a bit, the first difficulty is going forth. That's really difficult, to actually to decide to commit yourself to the path, to go for refuge. That is the first difficulty. So it's Sariputra talking to a young bhikkhu, and the young bhikkhu says, okay, let's suppose that I've gone forth and I've committed myself. What next? He said, what's difficult next is finding delight. And that's one of the themes of this retreat. How do we find delight? And of course, we part of the answer is that we find delight through great art, through great literature. There was something else I was going to say about that, but I can't remember what it is.
It's a good way of non-being, is that what you said?
Sorry?
Did you say it's a good way of non-being?
He said it's a good way of non-being. Because, presumably, obviously, it puts you in a very positive state of mind. It elevates your consciousness and it makes you more and more prepared to actually develop insight. Okay. I must move on. So the last three items, I've got three more little items in my presentation. And they're nothing to do with reminiscences. I've finished that. And the first is to do with kinetics. The first point is related to kinetics. The second is related to looking. And the third is related to listening. And I wanted to share this because there are three little things that have really inspired me more recently. And the first is a film that I'm sure a lot of you will have seen, but I want to talk about it. And this is where the kinetics comes in. It's to do with movement. And it's a film, it's a Japanese film called Departures. which I've watched a couple of times. And it's about a young man who's a musician. He loses his job and he moves into the country where his family used to be, and he needs to find a job, and he sees an advertisement in the newspaper, and it's that sort of, the advertisement is about departures. He thinks it's a travel agent's, but actually it's a funeral parlour. And the job is actually preparing dead bodies for funeral. And he's actually appalled. But the chap also offers him the job on the spot, and he's destitute, so he needs it. He's got to support his wife, and she's pregnant, so it's important. Anyway, he does. And he's sickened by his first experiences. The first body they go to is in this house where the woman's been dead for 4 or 5 days, and he spews up, he's so sick. But then he watches the master prepare this body, and he's the assistant, he's the apprentice, and he just watches the man do it, and it's wonderful to watch, it really is. One day the master says, they get him and the body's there, and he says, "You can do this one." So he does. And he becomes a really, really master body preparer for, I don't know what you say, for the funerals. And what struck me about it was the beauty of mindfulness. Mm. The beauty of mindfulness. This is a corpse. And the family are sitting there, by the way, I forgot to say, the whole family is sitting there watching this performance. So he can't make a mistake. He mustn't handle the body roughly, because that would be very upsetting. So he does it. And it's like a slow dance, really. The way he moves different parts of the body, the way he slips the correct robes, takes the existing robe off and puts the next robe on. And it's really a joy to watch. And it reminded me of that thread in Japanese culture. I lived in Japan for 4 years in the early 90s. And the Japanese, it's a funny culture. It's a very mixed culture. But one aspect of Japanese culture is very ritualistic. And this, the way those bodies were prepared, was a great, beautiful ritual. And the Japanese are fantastic at wrapping things. They really are. It's an art form. I mean, you go to a, let's not say little shops, but you go to a big department store in Japan, say Mitsukoshi, which is once I went to Mitsukoshi at 10 to 9. They don't open till 9. And at 9 o'clock, a bell rings, boom, very solemn bell, the doors open, and you walk in. And all the people who work there have formed two files of, what do you call it? Anyway, you know what I mean? And the customers, the first customers, walk through, and as you walk through, they're all going. It's amazing. And when you get to the counter, when you've bought your thing, whatever it is, and I remember I bought an object rather than an article of clothing, and the way this beautiful young shop assistant, the way she actually put the object in this beautiful little box, and then she wrapped it in this paper and folded the paper so carefully, so beautifully, and then tied a sort of ribbon around in a fantastic way. It's a performance. It's great. Sometimes, though, it can get a bit sort of cold, and you want to cut through and let's get on with it. Okay, that's my kinetic bit. The beauty of mindfulness. Mindfulness of the body. The second is to do with looking. It's to do with the fleshly eye, the human eye. I think there's a hierarchy of eyes in Buddhist teaching, isn't there? And I think fleshly eye, the human eye, in this realm anyway, comes at the bottom. So this is to do with the human eye. I got better at looking since I started learning to draw. I've been learning to draw for quite a few years now, and I'm not a very good draftsman, I have to say. It's not in my blood. But it's a fascinating experience, learning to draw. Because in order to draw, you have to look. You have to look and see what is really there, and you have to try and get rid of your projections. Sometimes they talk about it in terms of get into the right side of the brain and don't let the left side of the brain interfere, which it does. And it's a very humbling experience, because sometimes the tutor comes round and says, can't you see that the distance between that knee and her chin, you know, it's much smaller than you've got there. And I look, oh, gosh, there it is. Yeah. It's really irritating and humbling. And it teaches you, wow, I'm not really looking. I'm not seeing what's there. Glaring errors of proportion. It's also helped me to look at drawings and paintings in art galleries. It's improved my aesthetic education in terms of looking. And it's related, on quite a sort of low level, to in the scene, only the scene. The Bahia story. Just what's there. Just look and appreciate. Yes, and just to finally finish on that point, I've been dipping into the poet Rilke recently, and I came across a very interesting passage in one of his diaries. And at a certain stage of his development, he went to live in Paris, and he went to live with the sculptor Auguste Rodin. And he revered Rodin. He really loved him, and he really rated his sculpture. And he was going through a dry period at the time. He hadn't written any poetry. He couldn't write any poetry. And so he told Rodin about this, and Rodin said, okay, he said, what you need to do, he said, you need to go to the zoo. And Rodin said, oh, really? He said, yeah. He said, go to the zoo, choose an animal, any animal, it doesn't matter what it is, and look at it. And he said, it may take a few hours, it may take a few days, it may take several weeks, but just go and do it. So he went. And he chose a panther. And he looked at this panther, day after day, hour after hour, for I don't know how long, but I think it was certainly longer than a week. And eventually, the gates burst, and he went back to his room, and he wrote his first poem for a month, and it was called Panther. And then he wrote another one. He'd looked at other animals as well. So I thought that really struck me, that the artistic creation involves actually being receptive to the world outside. You really have to look at an animal in order to write a poem about it. It's like the Zen teaching of, you know, you've got to look at bamboos for several years, the Zen master says, and then you finally take up your brush and put your first marks down. Gosh, it's 5 to 4, I'm sorry. It's going on a bit, aren't I? Just one more. Can I finish off? The last one is listening. And this is to do with the transformative power of beauty. So what I'm saying here is that exposing ourselves to beauty, it's not just an aesthetic experience, but it changes us. It actually changes us. And I've experienced this, I think, as an experience of exposing myself to beauty over the last few years has actually changed me for the better. And I think we've all experienced this to a small degree. I haven't really time to go into this poem of Rilke's, but it's basically about listening. I'll try and squeeze it into just a couple of minutes. And it's the first sonnet to Orpheus. And Orpheus is the god or half-god of music. And he wrote 50-odd sonnets to Orpheus. And in the first sonnet, Orpheus sings. He also plays his lyre. And he's in a forest. And he sings. And then there is silence. And out of the silence, all sorts of beasts come out. Yeah? And he says in the poem, they don't come out, I'm paraphrasing, they don't come out of the forest through cunning. You know, they're not going to go eat you. And they don't come out of the forest through fear, but through listening. And then the next lines sort of say, all that roaring, and bellowing, and barking, they've left it all behind. They see it's very crude, it's useless. Yeah. And, yes, I've got to go to the poem just to finish this off. He says in the final verse, and where before there was hardly a shed where this listening could go, a rough shelter, ein Unterschlupf in German, a rough shelter put out by brushy longings with an entrance gate whose poles were wobbly, you created a temple for them deep inside their ear. Da schufst du ihnen temple im Gehör. That's the last line. I thought, when I read this poem, I thought, that's wonderful. It's about the transformative power of music, but it's also, to me, it's the transformative power of art. Yeah, it's when something gets in, it expands. And it also relates, and I'm finishing here, honestly, it relates to this having to go back. I think it's Subhuti talked about it quite a bit, having to go back to the dark stuff. Or, you know, and he was saying that actually even in that dark stuff, even in that cruelty and whatever we were talking about, horror films, horror stories, there is something that is worthy, that is, as it were, a seed of beautiful. And I think it's right that maybe we have to go back. At times, we have to go back to this kind of stuff. And it reminded me of Yeats, the great Anglo-Irish poet, W.B. Yeats. And I can't remember the poem, but it's a late poem. And again, he has he's sort of lost his inspiration. And he talks about inspiration in terms of ladders which take you up, higher up the scale of beauty. And he can no longer sort of go up those ladders. He's sort of fallen down to the lowest rungs. And he says at the end of the poem, I have to go back to where the ladders start. Yeah? To the foul rag and bone shop of the heart. I have to go back to the start, to the foul rag and bone shop of the heart. No. I have to go back to where the ladders start. That's right. I have to go back to where the ladders start, to the foul rag and bone shop of the heart. And if you do that, then maybe you can get onto the first, second round again and you're off. So that's, I'm going to finish with that and just say that, wherever we are on the ladder, and we may have to go down a few rungs, or we may be high up on it, to really get it. Well, I'd just like to finish by wishing you all well on your ascent of the ladder of beauty.
Thank you very, very much, Abhay. It's so good to hear you speak. I haven't heard you give a talk for a long time. And, I could listen to you for a very, very long time. You're such an engaging speaker. And there's so much in that talk. But I just love it when you talk about Bunty. I could listen to you for hours. And I've heard you, for I was in a Kalyana Mitra ceremony with Abhay a while back with somebody, and we were having tea and cake afterwards, and Abhaya just got into a groove talking about all kinds of Bunty stories, and some of them, they were different from the ones today. But you really hold something for our spiritual community in those. They're more than reminiscences, as you say. You do hold a myth there for us, and I hope that they're recorded. I think you've written about them as well, and it's so lovely as well to hear you talk about poetry and art generally. And I can remember that talk you gave on Buddhism and Keats, and I love it when you talk about poetry. I mean, I hope you will do more of this. I think it's very, very important, and I'm so glad that you could speak to us today. So thank you very much indeed. I've got a reminiscence about Abhaya, actually. He was one of the first order members I ever met. He was on a seminar with Bunty, I think on the Dhyana for Beginners seminar, I think, or the Dhyana for Beginners, wasn't it? And that was down near Brighton. And Buddhadasa, who was running the centre, I was just I don't know if I was even in the community then, I was very young. And there was this study group, and Buddhadasa invited Abhaya to come, and there was a meditation before the study group. And I and the other Mitra was just amazed, because Abhaya sat there for the whole meditation in Anjali Mudra, like this. He doesn't remember it. And we thought, wow, what a devoted man. And he is a devoted man. So thank you once again for such a wonderful talk. Thank you. And I think we'll have let's have the meditation at 4:45. So there's a decent break. Is that okay? Yes? And do we need to say anything about tomorrow yet? Or are we going to...
We don't know
what we're going to do. Okay.
That's right.
So something will happen.
Well, it'll be very short announcement.
Sorry,
it's okay.